Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guests are going to be Ryan Reising and Alexa Levy. And they are coming out from the Permaculture Action Network, which is a nonprofit collective in California that actually works around the country, creating hands-on action days. And I will tell you more about both of them and what they're doing when they are coming on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you what is going on here in the New York area, some things in the news that you want to know about. Last night, I had a great event at the Brooklyn Public Library, part of their Climate Wednesdays, where we were talking about food, food and its connection to climate change and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that come out of our agricultural sector. And, you know, depending on what model you're looking at, whether you're including transportation of food or not, you know, it can be anywhere from 14% to, you know, 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So it's really a significant portion of climate crisis. And the discussion last night was really great. Nancy Romer, who was the founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition and was a professor at Brooklyn College for many, many years and is working with the People's Climate Movement and 350 Brooklyn, she was speaking along with Onika Abraham, who is the executive director of Farm School NYC. And we were talking about farming and organic agriculture and, you know, social justice in the food movement and the reality of land and access to land and black farmers on the land in relationship to white farmers and how many black farmers have lost their land. And it was just a great discussion. The Climate Wednesdays at 350 Brooklyn are putting on at the Brooklyn Public Library is just a wonderful program, and they will be coming back on. They're taking a break now for the holidays, but they'll be back on February 12th with another Climate Wednesdays called Our Bodies, Our Planet, and it's Public Health and the Climate Crisis at the Brooklyn Public Library, the one on Grand Army Plaza. And so it's a beautiful space. I had never been there before, and we had a, you know, full room. Unfortunately, the room only held like 60 people, so there were people out the door and sitting on the floor, but there was great discussion, and it was just really, really lovely. Getting ready for this weekend, actually, yeah, this weekend I will be starting to collect coats and secondhand jewelry and toys for the River Fund New York, which is the nonprofit organization that I've been working with for so many years, cooking great meals during Thanksgiving, Christmas, and other holidays. However, if any of you have been following the saga, they lost their permit to serve fresh food in the park. It seems like the neighborhood is undergoing gentrification. The abandoned hospital, Jamaica Hospital, that was right across the street from the park has been sold and turned into condos, and I guess they no longer want to attract people in need to the park. So they are allowing them to continue to go in to distribute coats and toys and other pantry food items, but no cooked food. So we are not doing our cooking for Christmas during Thanksgiving because they couldn't get the permit. We did our cooking, but instead of going to Rufus King Park, where we had been for the past 20-some-odd years, we went to the Pink Houses in Brooklyn, which is a project in Brooklyn. And it ended up being so lovely, and we were hoping we could maybe even go back there this time. But I think the organization felt bad for the people in and around Rufus King Park who ended up not being serviced during the Thanksgiving time, so they did want to go back there, at least with the mobile food pantries, so they can help alleviate some hunger to that community. And hunger is a real issue in and around our city and across the country. I've been reading, you know, so many articles about, you know, supermarkets closing down, dollar stores taking over in these small rural towns and putting grocery stores out of business. The Walmarts and the drugstores are now carrying, you know, frozen food and canned items. And so people are doing away with the grocery stores, or not people, or I should say the grocery stores are moving out because there's not enough profit for them staying in these small towns. And it's just really a terrible situation. Lots of small towns are starting their own kind of co-ops, so, you know, cooperative community grocery stores. And, you know, who knows what wonderful things might come of that. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people having a hard time getting fresh fruits and vegetables. As many of you know, I am working at Glen Cove Public School, bringing more fresh vegetables into the school lunch program and doing a monthly taste test with a different vegetable. And this week I actually made apple crisps. It's fruits and vegetables. And mostly I've been doing vegetables that they normally are not eating. I did beets, asparagus, Swiss chard, pumpkin. But coming up with the holidays and the fact that so many kids won't even taste the vegetables that I am distributing, I wanted to make something that everybody would love. So I made an apple cobbler with, you know, no nuts because it's a nut-free school, of course. But I made a really great apple cobbler with honey and lemon and oats on top. And the kids loved it, and it was just so nice to be in the cafeteria of these different schools handing out a treat for these kids. I served it warm, and they just were gobbling it up. I had to cut some people off because I needed to make sure I wasn't going to run out, but it was a nice feeling to see the kids so happy to be eating apple cobbler made with fresh New York State apples. So that was really nice. If any of you read my newsletter, if you don't, you can sign up to receive my weekly newsletter. But I talked about fake fish, which is making its debut. We've all been hearing a lot about the fake meat that's out there, some better than others. And now fake fish is hitting the market. And back in 2018, I interviewed Chad Sarna, who is one of the brothers behind the great vegan cookbook, Wicked Healthy. And he talked on the radio show about this venture he was doing with his brother, Derek, where they were working with a European Union supermarket chain to develop a faux fish. And they came out with it, and their company is called Good Catch. And they have three different types of tuna-free tuna, three different flavors. One's plain, Mediterranean, and oil and herbs. And I have not tried it yet, but I'm told, you know, it's made with six different legumes, and it actually has a flaky texture that resembles tuna fish. And they put in some algae oil to give it that little bit of fishy flavor. And I've heard it's really great, so I'm looking forward to giving that a try. There was this article that lists six other fish companies or faux fish companies. One is called Ocean Hugger Foods, and they came out with, there's a picture I put in my newsletter of a faux ahi tuna sashimi. That looks so real, it's amazing. So that looks really amazing. So anyway, check out that article about faux fish hitting the market. You know, I do not have the stats on it yet as to whether it's genetically modified free. I would certainly guess that the faux fish coming out of Good Catch with the Sarno brothers is, because we talked a lot about GMOs and they know the dangers of that. So anyway, check that out. Because one thing we did talk about last night at our Climate Wednesday about the Green New Meal is really the effort that we all have to put into compromising the foods that we might want to eat to the foods that are sustainable. And eating meat three times a day is absolutely not sustainable. And I am not advocating that everyone become vegan, but I am advocating that if you are going to eat meat, you eat much less of it and you make sure that you are sourcing it from farmers who are taking care of the soil and taking care of their animals in a humanely, loving way. So just food for thought for you all to think about while you are planning your meals. And, of course, food waste was also a big issue. And I've been doing a lot in the last year to use as much of the parts of the food that normally would get wasted to incorporate into new foods. Of course, I've always been composting, but still trying to use more of the vegetable than I used to. I use my beet green tops and my radish green tops now to make things. My onion skins, you know, I'm using all the ends of my vegetables. I wash them off and I make stock with them. So there's a lot of things you can do before you put them into the compost bucket. So do that. As I mentioned, this weekend I am starting gathering coats and toys for Christmas in the park for those in need. So if you have any winter coats or clothing items that you can drop off here at the IE Green Homestead in Old Westbury, it would be much appreciated. We also gather secondhand jewelry. So this is jewelry that you once loved, but it's now in your jewelry box and you have so many new earrings and nicer earrings that you're not wearing the old ones. You know, polish them up, stick them in a box, and drop them off here, and we will give them away because so often we have lots of toys for parents to pick up to give to their young ones, but we don't have many things for the teenagers. So the jewelry is just a wonderful gift and repackaged. It looks brand new, and it's just a wonderful option. Also coming up, save the date for two things. One, the Real Truth About Health Conference, which is coming up on January 24th through February 2nd. This is a free conference that is put on, funded by the Hippocrates Institute in Florida, and they have a lineup of unbelievable speakers in person, one of which is Jeffrey Smith, who after he speaks there, he will be staying around on January 26th. He is going to be speaking after a film screening that Slow Food North Shore is having at the Landmark on Main Street. And that is going to be on January 26th, and we will be screening Jeffrey Smith's new film called Secret Ingredients, all about GMOs and the downside and how we are really an experiment. Our society is an experiment of what happens when you eat GMOs for a few decades and the health outcomes. And I would say if you look around, those health outcomes are not very promising. So you want to do away with GMOs, but come on out and see Secret Ingredients with us on January 26th. Slow Food North Shore, which is the local chapter of Slow Food here on Long Island, will also be hosting an event on January 11th at the Village Wine Merchant. And this is a wine tasting of organic and biodynamic wines that the wine merchant is, the proprietor there, is going to be selecting for us to try. We will be sampling four different wines. He will be talking about each one, about the vineyards and how the wines are produced, and there will be pairings for each of the wines that you taste, and tickets are $30 for members and $40 for non-members. And we'd love to see you there. That's January 11th in Seacliff at the Village Wine Merchant. And the last thing I want to tell you about is the second annual Zero Waste Summit that is coming up on March 24th through the 26th. So save the date for that. Oh, I didn't mention the NOFA conference, which is also coming up, the NOFA Winter Conference, which is always a wonderful, wonderful event. And this year, it's taking place actually up in Syracuse instead of Saratoga Springs, which is normally where it is. And so it will be up in Syracuse the weekend of January 17th through the 19th. So save the date for that. The NOFA New York is stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and we have a local chapter in New York as well as all the other New England states. And this is a conference that is put on every year that has also unbelievable speakers and time to just really connect with other farmers and consumers and food activists. So if you can make it to that, I highly recommend it. I want to share with you my recipe for the week. which is the apple cobbler that I made in the school. And it just, you know, was so great. Everybody was asking for the recipe, so I wanted to share this with you. And so you're going to do approximately 15 organic apples, but depending on the size, the ones that I had at the school were relatively small, so I used probably a few more. But you want to fill whatever size pan you are making it in. So if you're doing a full, flat chafing pan, you might need more. But anyway, the ratio is about 15 organic apples to a half a cup of honey, a tablespoon of lemon juice, a tablespoon of organic cornstarch or a non-GMO cornstarch, and one tablespoon of cinnamon. And you just mix that up, spray the bottom of the casserole pan that you're going to be using, and just pour that filling right in there. And then using the same, you're going to make the topping, which is a cup of flour. If you want this to be gluten-free, you can use a gluten-free flour and gluten-free oats. And then you're going to put 2 cups of the oats in, a cup of organic brown sugar, 2 teaspoons of cinnamon, and a cup of organic canola oil or safflower oil or coconut oil, whatever oil you like to use. And you're going to mix that up and then sprinkle that on top of the cobbler. And you're going to bake it at 375 for about 50 minutes. If the top starts browning too much, you can cover it with some tin foil. So just watch that. You know, the back of my oven is hotter than the front, so I always have to turn it midway. But you should know your oven and do whatever you need to do to make it come out really delicious. And that's it. I love feedback, so if you do make the recipe, please let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guests this week, Ryan Rising and Alexa Levy. And they are coming to us from the Permaculture Action Network, which is a continent-wide collective that mobilizes thousands of people to take direct action on regenerative projects with a diversity of groups and organizations. And they partner very often with performing artists, cultural events, and a diversity of grassroots groups working toward collective liberation to create days of action and educational spaces in which people regenerate ecosystems and catalyze the movement for a just transition. And Ryan's been a community organizer for many years. He's also a project facilitator and permaculture educator based out of San Francisco Bay Area. And he's the co-founder of the Permaculture Action Network. And, you know, back in 2014, he, along with the music producer, the Polish Ambassador, started the Permaculture Action Tour, where they toured around the country, putting on concerts, and then doing days of action following that. And back then, actually, I actually cooked for their New York event. I made a big pot of chili and brown rice, and that's where I first met the folks with the Permaculture Action Network. And he's been doing lots of hands-on activities and action days, building greenhouses, rainwater catchment systems, perennial food gardens, and regenerative systems at more than 100 different community spaces, including public food forests, urban farms, and indigenous food sovereignty projects. And Alexa, his partner, is an educator, public school teacher, and permaculturist, organizer, and artist. And she has been dedicating her life working with underprivileged youth as a facilitator of learning, offering them tools to becoming their best self. And she started Permaculture and Restorative Justice Program at the Claremont Middle School in Oakland, where together she and her students learn about growing food, art, creating regenerative systems, current events, and social justice, all while practicing restorative justice. And Alexa's been exploring alternative avenues of education in search of piecing together an educational utopia where justice and compassion are at the forefront. Good luck, Alexa. Anyway, welcome, Alexa and Ryan. Are you with me?
Hi, Bhavani.
Hello, Alexa. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
We're good.
Hi, Ryan. Great. So I thought maybe we could just start by each of you sharing, I gave a little bit of your history, but how you first got involved with permaculture and your inspiration behind this one for you, Ryan, founding the Permaculture Action Network.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, the stories, I love how linked they are to your work, Bhavani. One of the first things I ever started actually getting to practice the kind of organizing and action I wanted to see in the world was through an organization called Food Not Bombs in North Jersey, which is very similar to what Community Solidarity over there in Long Island.
Actually, Community Solidarity used to be Food Not Bombs, and
right,
they changed their name to Community Solidarity mainly so they could become a nonprofit so they could take donations, because I guess Food Not Bombs wasn't. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's, you know, one of the first things I was doing out in New Jersey growing up there. Probably started doing that when I was like 14, 15 years old. I was doing other kinds of work out there. We would collect books and send them to prisoners. We would build bicycles for immigrant day laborers around North Jersey. And we would also do things like mobilize down to Washington, D.C., and other places where these kind of political economic summits were happening to demonstrate against things like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So I was doing that organizing from a very young age. And then when I moved up to Massachusetts to study around like 18 years old, I started learning about permaculture and ecological design. And basically how we are going to actually have a relationship with the earth and its ecosystem in a way that provides the material needs that we need as people and we need for our loved ones and this kind of thing, but in a way that is healing to the earth, that's not extractive. So a lot of my inspiration was taken from folks like the Zapatistas down in Chiapas, Mexico, and of course people all over the world who have been combining by necessity often land-based practices and the practice of actually creating what we need with our own hands with creating a more liberatory world socially and economically. So I was studying out in Massachusetts for a while. I ended up moving
in college?
Out to, for a little while before moving out to the Bay Area in California. And right before I went out there, Occupy Wall Street started in New York City. And I'd grown up in New Jersey my whole life, so I was there for the first day of Occupy Wall Street and then for the next 2 days after that. And I got to experience the very first general assemblies that happened in Zuccotti Park and a lot of the first organizing that was happening there. So when I went out to California with the intention of starting to grow food and grow building materials and really homestead on the land 365 days a year, that kind of shook everything up right before I actually went out. So I'd been planning to go out to California, came down to Occupy Wall Street for those first days, and experienced a lot of what I'd been hoping for many, many years growing up, which was a kind of moment of people coming into the streets, coming into community with each other, and starting to take direct action to at least begin to model the kind of world that we want to live through starting to shape it in a public space with one another and see what it actually is like to make decisions together and to share material resources together and to start living in a way that's not based only on how much someone can pay for something or who has more power than someone else in a decision or whatever. So that was really inspiring. And when I got out to California, I ended up not going toward the more northern territories of California to start homesteading, but instead found myself in San Francisco facilitating some of the first general assemblies that were happening out there. And of course, that started to spread to Oakland, to Berkeley, to cities all across the United States. And, you know, similar movements were happening around the world, the Indignados movement in Spain, and the movement of the squares and things happening in Greece and Tahrir and all these places. And then in the Bay Area, we started to move some of that energy towards an action in 2012 that was called Occupy the Farm. And that was an action where a piece of land that was owned by the University of California at Berkeley was taken over and turned into a community farm. Now, this comes after 20 years of local folks in the Bay Area doing basically everything that you're supposed to do through the political system in order to create something that a community wants, right? So they came up with master architectural plans for what a farm on this land would be. They met with all the different stakeholders. They met with the university, they met with the city, they brought town halls together, they signed petitions and wrote letters and tried to put forward referendums and all of these kind of things. And after 20 years, the land was still being looked at as basically a financial resource for the university. So after developing 80% of it already since the early 1900s, they were going to turn the last parts of it into a Whole Foods, a strip mall that included like a bank and a Panera Bread and all of these kind of things. And so taking the inspiration of the Occupy movement, folks started organizing to turn that piece of land into a community farm through direct action. And so we mobilized a pretty large food sovereignty march. We brought a bunch of people to that piece of land and we turned it into a farm, and people continued to camp there at night and wake up in the morning and farm, and thousands of people from around the Bay Area would come and would farm that piece of land together. And, you know, that went through its own struggles. If you want to ask some questions later, we can get into the particularities of how that went. But generally, the way it went was that, you know, the usual kinds of repression that we would expect for a project like that happened. However, we were able to stake enough of a claim of community support that we still have a community farm there on that land to this day. We have an acre and a half community farm where people grow food, organically grown, often regeneratively grown food, and distribute that food for free to people all over the Bay Area. So I was doing a lot of organizing in similar realms after that, either defending urban farms and permaculture farms and similar spaces around the Bay Area, Oakland, San Francisco, et cetera, from being, you know, turned into condominiums or otherwise evicted, or starting new projects. And then this opportunity came in 2014 to organize this permaculture action tour. It was just after I'd actually gone down to Chiapas, Mexico to visit with the Zapatistas during the Escuelita, which was the moment where the Zapatista movement invited international folks to come from around the world and learn from them and study how they organized and how they're building their own autonomy locally in Chiapas, Mexico. And then I was in a series of discussions down in Costa Rica and Nicaragua and ended up having this opportunity to organize the Permaculture Action Tour. And so we did that. We organized this tour with Mr. Liff, who's a hip-hop artist, Ayla Nerio, the Polish ambassador, where they went around and they played these 32 concerts from San Diego to Seattle to Boston to Jacksonville, Florida, and everywhere in between. And after every concert, we would invite the audience out to a day of action the next day. You know, nobody in these crowds was really expecting anything more than going to a concert that night. They were going to their local music venue for 2 or 3 hours of music. And what they ended up finding was the artists that they were going to see were on stage inviting them to come out to an action day. Local community organizers who were operating the projects they were being invited to were coming up on stage between sets and talking about the work that they're doing locally in each city. Our team was there interacting with folks in the audience, flyering the crowd, inviting people. And we started, you know, the first 1 or 2 action days, we'd have 100 people come or 150 people come. And within like the first week of doing this, we were starting to have 300 people, 400 people coming to each of these action days in cities across the United States. And for those of us who've been doing community organizing for a while, especially in this world that you're involved in of urban farming and food justice and some of these ideas that are a little harder to translate to people, how they relate to collective liberation and social justice and these kind of things, like how does gardening connect to that? You know, it's often a question that's a little harder to answer for people. So to see 300 people, 400 people coming out and really realizing the importance of this work, or at least taking the chance of going and experiencing it on the ground for the first time and seeing what it was really inspiring for us. And so we carried out that entire tour, and seeing the efficacy of it, we decided to continue doing the work, create an organization out of it. And now Alexa and I are sitting here 4 years later, having now done 100 of these permaculture action days across the continent and mobilized 15,000 people to these days of action.
Yeah, not knowing how many people are going to come out, how do you organize, you know, an action day where you need tools and you need equipment to really, make all those people be productive while they're there? You know, how do you guesstimate that?
So it really depends on the artist that we're working with, and we kind of build up the momentum by the partnership with our artists. So, like, in more recent years, we organize Action Days with a mobilizing artist and have time to plan to promote the Action Day. So the artist will shout it out. It's a little bit different than what happened on the first tour, which was a bit more, it was really one after the other because it was in a six-week time period. Now we have a lot more time to plan for Action Days because we're not necessarily going on six-week tours anymore, which we've done in the past few years, but we're not frequently going on such congested tours. And so we are partnering with artists and have time to really plan for what that Action Day will look like and the outreach that happens from that artist. And it's really just become something where now we're expecting at least, like, you know, around 300 people to come. But it also depends. Like, we know in certain times, we just had an Action Day in Nashville, and it's November, and it might be colder, so we can estimate that it might be a few less people than 300. But we really are... It's just become something that we estimate for a larger amount of people, and we work with the community site to accommodate for that.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting. You know, one of the things that I love about it is, and I guess this is, you know, why you partner with musicians, but it's a way of really getting young people involved, because so often in the circles that I am seeing when I'm, you know, when we're having events, very often it's, you know, an older generation who are, you know, have a little more time in their hands. You know, young people are, you know, busy and working and, you know, very often they haven't made it yet their priority, even though it's, you know, the problems that are happening on the earth are going to, you know, be felt more by that generation than my generation, for instance, but although my generation helped create the problem more than your generation. But anyway, just to get the young people involved is so wonderful, because that's been a challenge in, you know, in the circles that I've seen. You know, I mean, I don't know if you know this, Ryan, but I actually had the phone number for the Occupy Kitchen. So, you know, anytime I had leftover food or was, you know, came across food that I could bring to the Occupy Wall Street movement, I would just, you know, call up, say, I'm bringing down this much salmon or this much this, and it was great to have a place that I knew I could always bring my leftovers.
Yeah, there's like a common thread there that I think is what really supports what you're talking about, the effect of getting young people to mobilize and to start getting their minds and their hands into this kind of stuff. And to some degree, there's an approach there that's looking to reach someone where they're inspired through direct experience rather than reach people through a pitch to them around like logic or reason or why this thing is important or this thing is unjust and someone needs to do something about it. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, I have followed that path of argumentation and trying to motivate people to action since I was young and continue to in a lot of ways, like part of organizing for greater equality and social justice in a world that we want to see necessitates that. However, there's a common thread there around like Occupy and around these Action Days where what we're actually speaking to is people's direct experience and desire for being in community, for experiencing collectivity, for experiencing communing with other people. For anyone that's gone to these kind of dance music events or kind of the more alternative gatherings and festivals and these kind of things, there is a sense of collectivity and community there that we don't find in daily life very often, at least most of us who are, you know, in some ways isolated from one another, whether it's because we're behind, you know, the computer screen or behind the windshield of the car or working, you know, 40 hours a week. Or in other ways isolated by kind of the mechanics of the economy around us. And when you go to a place like that, even if it's a 3-hour concert in the middle of your city, there is a kind of collectivity and community that people tend to find in that space. And we think that people are wanting more of that. So giving people an invitation based on that, that's based on, hey, this experiencing this that you're having, this fulfillment of that desire for being in connection with other people, being in relationship with a collective of people around you, let's go build that into the world so that we can experience that more regularly. Well, how are we going to build that into the world? Well, one of the things we're going to need to do is grow our own food. Another thing we're going to need to do is have community space that's not only space we can access if we have the money to pay for something or if we can rent or lease something. We need the commons again. Well, another thing we're going to need to do is actually have a water supply. So how do we manage water systems and how do we catch and store rainwater? Okay, how do we work with energy? How do we create electricity or renewable energy? And we say, okay, what do we need to do to go build those kind of regenerative commons into the world? Community spaces where people can meet material needs while also healing Earth's ecosystems, while also increasing biodiversity, doing it in a way where it's mutually beneficial, where that relationship between people and one another and people and the Earth is one of symbiosis, one of mutual benefit. So we say, okay, what do we need to do to go create those spaces into the world around us? And then we invite people out to these action days to actually physically do that, to build the composting and soil building systems, to plant the food forests and edible forest gardens, to install rainwater catchment systems and earthworks, to install renewable energy systems, and to create things that just provide that infrastructure of community space, to create an outdoor classroom or a greenhouse or a natural building or earthen benches or whatever it might be. So what we've found is that kind of invitation that goes to that level of direct experience and what people are desiring more of has been really effective. And I think that's also something that we saw in the Occupy movement was people came out to these plazas and squares and they experienced something that looked kind of like direct democracy or collective decision making that was beyond what they were used to, something that looked more like people sharing food and materials based on needs, something that looked more like a common space where workshops were being offered and people were able to commune with each other and create art and create media. And there was something there that I think kept bringing people back. That wasn't just the argument of, oh, okay, to make change, we need to gather together and demonstrate. It was, oh, this is a little fractal of the world that I want to see. So how do I keep coming back to this and spend more time here? And that's, I think, the part of the Occupy movement that we need to expand upon. And I think that's the part of these action days that's calling 300, 400 people to keep coming back even 4 or 5 years later.
Mm-hmm. I think you're so right. I mean, the need for community is, you know, well documented. I mean, and it's not just new, although I think the need's even getting stronger with, you know, technology being what it is and people spending so much time behind a computer screen or, you know, some sort of screen. But, you know, even back, you know, when I was younger and I got involved, you know, luckily the group I got involved with was, you know, Ram Dass and that more Eastern spiritual group. But, you know, that also came from a desire of wanting to be in a community of people, you know, and you meet people that you think, wow, these people are really cool. I want to know more about them. You know, and that's why I think so much proselytizing goes towards young people in their late teens, early 20s, because we're all seeking at that point. And that's why, you know, whether it just depends on who you happen to meet at that time in your life as to what you might get involved in, whether it's Scientology or, for me, it was, you know, Ram Dass and an Indian spiritual community. For other people, it's other type of, you know, religious sects or, you know, whatever it is. I think it's because we are looking for community. And, you know, if you look at different societies, very often they say, you know, like the a lot of these communities like Hasidic Jews or different, you know, yoga groups or whatever, the people are attracted to them because of the support of the community. And even if it's not necessarily the philosophy as much as just the people, and that's what keeps people in things very often, because we're all seeking community and that human connection that I think is not prevalent in our society in most realms. You know, a sharing, a real coming together. I mean, in our capitalist world, so much is competition and competitiveness, and you know, people don't want to share because they want the upper edge, and you know, and it's different, you know, in farming. You know, you go to these conferences like the Northeast Organic Farming Association conference that I was talking about. Farmers share ideas, you know, that it's not, at least the organic farmers, it's not so capitalist and competitive. It's more communal. And I think people are really seeking that. And I think you guys have really plugged into an energy that is really productive and needed, and, you know, you hit it on the mark. So, good for you. One thing I wanted to ask you, maybe you can just explain to my listeners, I think people hear of permaculture and don't totally really understand what it is. You know, is it the same thing as regenerative agriculture, which people are also hearing about? And if not, if they're not the same, what is the difference?
So, regenerative agriculture is definitely a big part of what permaculture is. The thing that the word permaculture does is allows us to look at a really whole systems approach, and a holistic approach that includes not only things that we might say falls outside of the realm of growing food or even more broadly agriculture, but includes things like social dynamics, economy, governance, things like that. So what I mean by that is, if we break down the word, right, what we're talking about is permanent agriculture, or even more broadly, permanent culture. So if we look at, okay, well, what is culture? It's the way that we make decisions together, the way that we create what we need from the earth materially, the way that we distribute or share those material things, the way that we facilitate economy, the way that we mediate conflict when it arises in our communities, the way that we create art and express ourselves. This is all part of this big bubble that we call culture. So how do we have a culture that can continue, that can last? Not a culture that's permanent as in static. We don't want it to stay the same, but we do want it to be able to continue because it's based on these patterns and principles that we see in natural systems. It's based on cycling energy back to where that energy came from, rather than what a lot of our dominant culture does, which is extract and then use and then discard. And so permaculture looks at these natural systems and it takes principles that we see at play in the world around us. One that I kind of just described the antithesis of is this idea of, you know, produce no waste. If we look at a forest system, if we look at most ecosystemic functions around us that are outside of human involvement, we see that nature doesn't really produce waste. Nature moves energy and moves material and cycles that into one form or the next. You know, leaves fall from a tree and they decompose and they feed the soil, and that soil grows plants and animals forage those plants, and then animals go and put seeds and fertilizer into the ground somewhere else, and this energy and material seems to, you know, cycle. And so we say, okay, well, how do we design our human systems to not produce waste? How do we design our systems so that the output of each element in our system becomes the input of something else? So that's one principle that we might look to. And there's a plethora of other principles that we look to in permaculture design to design how we are going to grow food, how we are going to grow and construct shelter with building materials. How are we going to collect and harvest water? How are we going to collect and create energy and electricity, medicine? We look at all of these things. So it goes beyond food as agriculture does in and of itself, right? When we're talking about agriculture, we are talking about material needs that go beyond food. But we're also going beyond agriculture, and we're actually looking at how can we create a culture broadly that's in symbiotic relationship with the natural world around us, where we kind of weave ourselves as humans back into an ecological web of life, where we are actually increasing biodiversity and affirming life by our choices. And then how do we take some of those principles and practices that work so well in nature and work so well when we apply those natural principles to material systems like growing food, And how do we then weave those into the ways that we work with one another, the ways that we make decisions, mediate conflict, facilitate economy? How can we apply those principles socially? And so this kind of gets back to that idea of social ecology, right? That we cannot have a healthy and equitable and beautiful social dynamic without having that same thing in relationship with our ecosystem. And we can't have a regenerative and sustainable ecological relationship, a relationship between humans and the environment, if we're not practicing those same kinds of relationships of regeneration and equity and mutual aid between one another as people. So permaculture looks at that, and it's useful for us because it starts with these ideas that are easier to grasp, like how do we grow food in a way that's regenerative? How do we look at perennial food growing? It starts with some of these things that are a little more tangible and easier for people to at least start practicing directly. It's a little easier to start a backyard garden or an urban farm than it is to like change everything around us all at once. So it starts there, and then it starts to move towards all aspects of life and look at how we can do that in a better way.
Mm-hmm. So with the organizing that you do, can you share with us what are some of the biggest challenges that you've had to face and overcome, and then maybe also some of your greatest successes?
Yeah. Okay, so there's two main challenges that I'll speak to. One is finding the financial resources to keep this kind of work up. So we've been doing this for 5 years now, and this isn't the kind of work that institutions, foundations, companies tend to be able to understand as like legible. It's so comprehensive and whole systems focused that it kind of goes beyond some of the more like direct service or single issue kinds of things that is fundable or that we can easily find resources around. So we've had a lot of success in, you know, crowdfunding and in just being really active in looking for small grants and different kinds of funding in this kind of way. But finding like consistent funding to actually do this kind of work on the scale that we've wanted to is a challenge. The other major challenge is that, you know, what we're doing is we're catalyzing broad movement building. So a lot of that goes beyond one's own control, which is actually a really great thing. But in the moment, that can feel a little bit difficult, right? It's a lot easier if we say, okay, we're going to get together and we're going to do this one project in this one place, and we're going to be able to manage it and more or less determine its success or at least have more agency over that. When we're doing this broad movement building, which includes community spaces and projects across the entire continent, that includes organizers across the continent that have to contend with issues in their own area, like building permits or like an organization that was supporting them financially dropping out, or some of the kind of internal people dynamics that come up in these kind of projects, you know, we're not able to manage all of that. So sometimes it can feel devastating when a project that we've supported and that we've poured a lot of love and energy into goes through their own challenges or their own struggles in their own geographical context, like gets shut down by the city or, you know, has an institution that was backing them kind of drop them or whatever it might be. So those are two of the challenges. It's like internally, how do we actually move financial resources into this work? How do we translate financial resources into community, soil, food for communities that don't have access to nutrient-rich and organic food, healthy, you know, ecologies. Basically, the traditional dominant economy doesn't really recognize having healthy ecosystems and healthy communities as something that money necessarily feeds, right? We are based in this profit-based system. So how do we break beyond that kind of financial paradigm and have folks understand that feeding financial resources into becoming healthy communities and healthy ecosystems through this decentralized kind of movement building is actually one of the best ways that we can be moving our resources. So that's one thing. And then the second is, how do we, you know, be okay with that? How do we be okay with the fact that this isn't a single project in a single place that we can have more control over, but that movements face challenges and projects get shut down and community groups go through their own problems, but we're building this greater kind of puzzle, this greater movement that's more than just one or two or several of the sites or projects within it. So how do we know that's all just part of the process? And for that, every shutdown of a project or challenge that a space might go through, the rest of our projects and the rest of our organizations are learning from that, and we're moving on to the next thing, and we're building something more together. Mm-hmm. In terms of the greatest successes, for me, the greatest success has been all of the people that have let us know that they were at a concert or they were at some event, they came to an action day, and now they are talking to us a year or 2 years later, and they are fully involved in this kind of work for the long run. And the reason I say that is because going out for a day of action and providing material solidarity to one of these community spaces, whether it be a low-income housing community that's installing edible landscaping systems and rainwater catchment, or an indigenous food sovereignty project in a rural area, or an urban farm, or whatever it might be, going out and providing a day of material solidarity where 200-300 people are working on hands-on projects, that's huge, and that's greatly needed. But what's even more greatly needed is hundreds, if not thousands, of people to take up this kind of work, this kind of action in their daily lives and remain committed to it. And when we hear that there's hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, who have basically come to an action day or otherwise been inspired by our work and now are taking this on full time. They're involving themselves in this work. They've joined a food justice organization. They got together with a group of friends and started an urban farm. They're looking at how to involve themselves in this kind of movement work for the long haul. Like, that's our greatest success, is basically
generating
movement by mobilizing lots and lots and lots of new, sustained, committed people into the work for the long haul.
That's the best. I'm so with you there, because that's what we need. We need a revolution, and we need, you know, thousands and thousands, if not millions, of people to take up this type of work and to make it a priority, so that the presidential candidates are just talking about regenerative agriculture. So they're talking about real food justice and social justice, and, you know, that these are in the forefront. You know, I mean, talking about health care, you know what? I'm so cynical at this point. I feel like, you know, the reason we're all so sick is because it's good for money. You know, it's good business. It keeps the doctors employed and the hospitals employed and the pharmaceutical companies employed and the bad food companies employed, you know. So, you know, there's no incentive to get us healthy. And, I just think that, you know, the more that we get people involved in really taking up social justice and healthy lifestyles, which should be regenerative agriculture and permaculture and all of that you're talking about, that is going to build the movement. And then we'll get, you know, politicians talking about that, because that's what will get them votes. And we really, you know, need to change the conversation and make this a huge, like I said, a revolution, because it's just happening with the same status quo, you know, at the pace that we're going. I mean, I've been in this for so many years, and I have to say that there is improvement. I mean, there is, you know, you certainly can get organic food now at a regular supermarket, which when I was younger, you could not. You know, so there is more access, but again, you know, we all know that getting organic food is a little bit more expensive, and so fortunately, right now, I can afford it, but there was a time when I couldn't, you know. I started as a single mom on food stamps. So I, you know about the struggle of putting food on the table and being able to support yourself. And so, I want everyone to have access to that good food. And, you know, the work you're doing, I just think is phenomenal. So thank you. So I know one other thing I want to touch on. I know that when we were talking, you don't like using the terms nonprofit or 501c3 organization. However, you are, and you want people to donate to you, and it is a tax-deductible donation, so it has a benefit, although the current president took a lot of those benefits away. But nevertheless, you know, people can make donations to you. Can you share with us why you shy away from those words and what words you would prefer people to use when describing your organization?
Yeah, essentially what we want is we want this kind of organizing to be as accessible to as many people as possible. And there's a great barrier there already. Like, we're not taught growing up, we're not really taught in this culture that starting new organizations and new projects and new spaces is necessarily something we can do. We're mostly taught to, like, become employed by some kind of company or institution or that already exists, or at most to kind of become entrepreneurial, to, you know, start a new top-down kind of business, to start a new venture in that kind of world. But we're not really taught that, like, the kind of work that you're doing with, you know, community solidarity in Long Island, or the kind of, you know, discussion that you put together last night. We're not really taught that those are things that we can go do. So we want people to feel that sense of agency and inspiration to go forward and create new projects and new spaces and new things. And taking away some of that institutional language, I think, allows people to do that, right? So the nonprofit is not what the thing is, right? Nonprofit is just a legal determination by the IRS that says that, you know, this entity over here doesn't have to pay taxes because it's not making for-profit income. And, of course, then that all gets manipulated in different ways, too. And we have these things like critiques coming forward of, like, a nonprofit industrial complex where we actually have a lot of institutional wealth kind of directing the work of these charities and these nonprofits rather than people directing the kind of change that their communities need through their own self-determination.
Yeah.
And so there's so much,
Ryan,
there.
Ryan, I'm just catching wind of the time, and we're going to run out. So I would like you to just share with people where they can find more information about your organization. I'll, of course, share that on my website, and where people can go if they do want to make a donation.
Thank you, Bhavani. Yeah, so we are at Permaculture Action Network on Facebook. We're also on Instagram, but Instagram's a little less text-heavy. That's at Permaculture Action, but do feel free to follow us. The best place to go read about us and our past work and everything like that is permacultureaction.org. So P-E-R-M-A-C-U-L-T-U-R-E, permacultureaction.org. There's a donate link on permacultureaction.org and also one on Facebook. You should be able to guide from our page to one of our organizers, and we're all running some, like, end of the year Giving Tuesday fundraisers and that kind of thing. And of course, write to us. We're at contact@permacultureaction.org, and we'd love to talk with you, and we'd also love to potentially work with different projects and organizations and spaces out there that might be listening. You know, this is what we do, is we mobilize people to these days of action, as well as put on courses and workshops and these kind of things.
Wonderful. Well, everyone out there, thank you, Ryan and Alexa. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you so much. I'll share all that information on my website at iegreen.com, so you'll be able to find it. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.